I think Delicate would have done as a phrase. It does
Yeah, but
give
I wanted
it.
a visual meta. Like, stop hating on my use of poetic devices,
Think
Jimmy.
you
It's not
said
nice.
fragile like sugar glass would have been better.
Okay, well, ask me how I'm feeling again.
How are you feeling, Jazza?
I'm fragile like sugar glass.
Doesn't
Better?
really have the poetry I think you were going for.
It has all of the poetry.
All of the poetry. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to episode 36 of the
Are we
Wrapped.
recording already?
Yeah, I've just been recording in the background. You're
You're a
moaning.
dick. I do not sign off on this copy.
It's on my computer now, so awkward, I guess.
Great.
But yeah, welcome to the 36th episode of the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name's Jimmy, and I'm joined as per usual by Jazza, who's not feeling too well at the moment.
I'm under the weather. I'm drugged up on paracetamol and things.
So Jazza is all set for a great
Responsibly.
weekend. Yeah, responsible drug abuse. This week we're going to be talking about, as per usual, three things. We're going to be talking about the US presidential election, the results of
Jumpy, 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 jumpy,
Super
jumpy, jumpy, jumpy.
Tuesday, and that man whose name Jazza is chanting in the background. Have you seen the John Oliver clip on Trump
It's
yet?
very good.
Yeah, it's
We should now be calling him Drumpf, right?
Drumpf, yes, as his. Is he from Poland originally, or his family are from
I
Poland?
think it's originally a German name. So John Oliver has done some digging and found out that Trump's original name, like generations ago, was Drumpf, and so he's created the hashtag make Donald Drumpf again,
I
which
mean,
is quite good.
I don't think the name Trump is that inspiring anyway, because you've pointed out
It
many
means
times. It
fart.
does mean fart, but it just doesn't sound particularly good, does it? Like, General Trump sounds like, a
Does
character from Dad's
sound a
Army.
lot better than Drumpf, though.
Yeah,
Although maybe that's
somewhat.
just because it gets lost in translation. Maybe Drumpf sounds great in German.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, some people have pointed out, it's a little bit. I don't want to use the word racist, it's tossed around too much, but some people have claimed that the Oliver thing is a bit racist, saying that Drumpf sounds a bit lame, even though it just does in English,
I mean,
unfortunately.
how is that racist? I'm not sure how that's racist.
It's more like xenophobic or
I mean, I
insensitive.
have a ridiculous surname. That's why I don't use it on the internet. I don't feel like that's racist.
I think that, I mean, you're the authority on this. There's different rules for different people. Your real surname is very Anglo-Saxon slash Celtic, so, it's not quite.
It's very like Irish rather than Anglo-Saxon. Well, anyway, let's not talk about the
Details.
surname that the listeners don't know exists. Our second topic is going to be the. Shall we do the Irish election second? Let's do the Irish election second. The Irish has just had their first general election since 2011, and in a very similar vein to that of the UK elections in 2015, they had their smaller coalition party get trounced. That it was the Irish Labour Party.
Get trumped, one might say. Pun.
Okay. And the two major parties, Fine Gael and Fine Fail, which I've definitely just pronounced
So
incorrectly.
it's Fianna Gael and Fianna Foyle. Fianna Fail, sorry.
Fine Gael and Fine Fail is what I'm going to be calling them, because I'm not going to be able to learn it between now and when we start the segment.
They really
But
need to
neither of them
pick
are going to be
more
able to form
distinct
a
names, I
coalition.
think, for foreigners. It's very confusing, very inconsiderate. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
It seems like there's going to be a hung parliament for a while. We're going to talk about how fractured European politics is and how, brain work.
Brainwork, indeed. And for the last segment, we were going to talk about Slough considering renaming itself, but Jazza was unimpressed with this topic. So,
If we chose to talk about Slough's renaming, we'd literally say, "Isn't Slough a bad name for a place? Is there anything else we can
we could talk
like
about The
that?"
Office, and there's parallels with Staines renaming itself to Staines upon Thames. Which doesn't
No,
really.
it hasn't.
Yeah, it has. That was ages ago, mate. See,
Well,
this is
who
a
calls
rich
it
vein
Staines
of
upon
commentary
Thames
that
then?
you've vetoed us exploring.
Yeah, but that would have been rather than 30 seconds of a conversation, about 3 minutes of a conversation. We're not doing Slough.
Okay, so what we're actually doing instead is the Snooper's Charter, really known as the Investigatory Powers Bill, or officially known, I should say, which Theresa May has resurrected and put back into Parliament this week. I've actually had the pleasure and enjoyment of reading quite a lot of the bills and documentation around
He
this
read it, so
piece.
you don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, I read it because I'm actually paid to read those sort of things, but in this case, it's going to come in useful for you because I could explain at least some of what's in the bill. But yeah, it's not looking good.
Yay.
Should we run the music?
Music. Bill. Super Tuesday was last week, and that is the day when a large number of US states go to vote for who is going to represent each of the major parties in the runoff in the US general election, or the US presidential election, that's going to be in November. So it looks like on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton has won enough delegates in order to probably end up being the nominee. The chances of lovely Bernie Sanders, although feeling the burn was a very good catchphrase. It looks like he's not going to be able to get enough votes to be able to become the Democratic nominee.
So it turns
On
out
the
a
public
strong
side,
hashtag is in fact not enough to get you the nomination in these things.
which bears well for Brexit, but for the Republican side, it's just an absolute shitstorm because Donald Trump, who we're pretty sure has been a Democrat before and is most well known for, you know who Donald Trump is, listener. I don't need to explain to you who he is. But he's coming across as rather sexist and racist, and is panicking ahead of it, really. The Republican establishment is kind of losing its shit over the whole thing and trying to figure out the best way of being able to not have Trump as their nominee. It's all kind of gone a bit tits up, really.
Yeah, I mean, that seems a fair summary of it. When Donald Trump first entered the race, we all thought for sure that some candidate, be it Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, or if you still remember him, or whoever else, would actually be able to rally enough support to defeat him in the Republican primary. But it now seems pretty certain that it's going to be a Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton contest.
Okay, well, so I don't think it shows that yet. I think that right now, what we see is Donald Trump definitely having the most votes at the end of the primary season. But it by the time they get to the national convention, I believe that the person who gets the nomination has to have gained a majority of the delegates. And what the Republican Party is trying to do now is getting as many people to stay in as possible, so that Donald Trump is starved of the nomination, essentially,
So when you
and then they
say,
get to have a vote at convention to see who they want to be the nominee, and therefore bypassing the whole democratic process.
so you're saying effectively the Democrat Party, or at least the De sorry, the Re Republican
The
Party,
Republican, yeah.
That turns up at the conference gets an effective veto on who gets chosen.
If so, I believe it's because it's if they don't, if there isn't a clear nominee, which is the way that they kind of have it written down in their party rules. If there isn't a clear nominee, then there will be a vote at conference. And they're trying to, so rather than it, because it looks like the three front runners are Trump, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz is very much like he's really, really disliked in the Republican Party just because he's a bit of a nut job and just isn't very, very liked. Marco Rubio is like the establishment figure, and everybody, so the mainstream media is very much like Marco Rubio is the real option now and the anti-Trump, and he isn't really. He won one state out of 11 in on Super Tuesday, and that's the only state he's won in the whole primaries. So the chances of Marco Rubio being able to at all is ridiculous and very far-fetched. And then there's John Kasich, who's another moderate who hasn't won a state, but is probably holding out until Iowa, which is his home state.
Even though I believe all of what you've just said, I do note that The Economist has run on its front page an image of Trump facing off against Clinton. So it does seem like, and that kind of reflects a lot of the commentary I've read in the last week. So it seems to be the consensus view in the media, at least at the moment, that it will be a Trump-Clinton contest at the end of the day.
I agree that that is the most likely, but it is still possible. Frankly, Jimmy, I'm clawing at whatever I can to try and get any glimmer of hope I can from the whole situation, because I have faith in the American people.
But do you have faith in the Republican Party?
No!
So, I mean, do we think that, irrespective of whether Trump gets the nomination, Clinton is probably still more likely to win, even if it turns out to be a Clinton-Cruz contest in
almost,
that event?
Almost definitely, even though I find it so frustrating, because I think that on my Facebook feed, an awful lot of people do tend to be left of centre, and certainly a lot of my American, my young American friends who are voting in primaries at the moment are enamoured with Bernie Sanders. And the amount of misinformation that is flying around in terms of who does well against each of the possible Republican candidates, against Cruz, against Trump, against Rubio, is ridiculous, because there has been some polling in the past that has shown that both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton beat all of them by like quite a significant amount, but Bernie Sanders can actually beat Trump more than Hillary.
Really?
And that's probably because of the amount of history that Hillary has, having kind of quite a lot of rotten eggs thrown at her over the past few decades, because she's been such a prominent public figure.
Suggest that some people who would vote for Bernie Sanders would not vote for Hillary Clinton and would either abstain or would vote for Trump? Is that what?
So this is the worrying thing that if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, that all of the people, because the thing is also not many people have been turning out for the Democratic primaries. The turnout has been reasonably low for the runoff against Hillary and Bernie, which doesn't bode particularly well for when Hillary kind of becomes the Democratic nominee and then has to face off against somebody like Trump, because she is still going to have to maintain some kind of like high level of engagement for her to be able to beat anybody, frankly. And so it's quite scary that she, like, it might end up being turnout that is like the biggest player in this election. But there have been whispers, and I do quite like whispers about vice presidential nominations, because they get to get a decent amount of power and a global profile by kind of just being liked by the potential presidential nominee, right?
So who are the potential vice presidents?
In the past, Trump has genuinely suggested that he'd assign Oprah as his VP. We'll see if that actually happens. I don't think there have been any whispers of anyone else.
Surely Oprah would be better than someone like Sarah Palin or something like that.
Sorry, say again.
Surely Oprah would be a better possibility than, say, Sarah Palin or someone like that.
Yes, I think so. There's whispers that Chris Christie, the reason that he's decided to endorse Donald Trump is because he kind of wants to, because he's termed out as governor of New Jersey and wasn't able to get the nomination to be president, and so he needed to find other options, and he's probably endorsing the front runner of the Republican Party so that there's the possibility of him being vice president. I doubt that Donald Trump would do that, just because of the way that we've heard Donald Trump talk to Chris Christie when he's thought that mics were off, like telling him to just get on the plane, go home, you're not wanted here anymore, has been hilarious.
That's a great video. If you haven't seen that, you should really look it up. But on the Clinton side of the equation, who do we think, or who do you think, that she will nominate as her potential vice president?
There's been a load of speculation. Quite a lot of people seem to think that she might actually go, she might go more conservative, to the right of her, and probably choose somebody of a diverse background. There's talk of a, of her choosing like a Latino male, I can't remember the guy's name, but a Latino male ex-governor, who would be particularly good in kind of that vein to bolster her Latin American kind of credentials. However, one that I did hear on the New Yorker podcast, a suggestion that I heard on the New Yorker podcast, and I have no qualms about repeating it here, is the possibility of having a two-lady ticket on the Democratic side. So Clinton choosing the Senator Elizabeth Warren as her running mate.
So
So Elizabeth Warren.
that's quite interesting, even aside from the having a two-woman ticket. Elizabeth Warren was mooted as a kind of Bernie Sanders type candidate to take the fight against the Wall Street banks and actually act as a candidate essentially for the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Exactly. So somebody like Elizabeth Warren maintains the momentum and the excitement of somebody like Bernie Sanders, and also is incredibly popular in her home state of Massachusetts, with the working class white vote, because of her policies on the big banks. And so would also be able to steal, a lot, but possibly be able to steal a large amount of support from the Trump campaign, which has mainly been working class and white. But
So,
obviously, encouraged by different reasons and motivated for different reasons.
it does seem to me, though, that from Clinton's point of view, it seems there is a danger that she doesn't engage with the Bernie Sanders supporters who are disappointed that Sanders hasn't got the Democratic ticket, and therefore she has some incentive to move to the left and actually try and pick them up. And I guess picking Warren as her vice would actually. Would actually achieve that. But on the other side of the equation, she probably wants to pick up as many centrist swing voters as possible, which would give her an incentive to move to the right, I guess. Although, in Democratic terms, she's considered pretty right wing as it goes.
There are a large number of people, I think actually a significant minority of people in the US who would never vote for Hillary Clinton in a million years, no matter who was her running mate. I think that this, choosing Elizabeth Warren as a running mate would be something that maintains momentum that has been created, and maintains excitement in the young ranks of the Democratic Party. Rather than kind of dropping them by being like, oh God, we lost. If she chooses somebody like Elizabeth Warren, then that excitement and that kind of call for, like, she becomes the change candidate again. She becomes as exciting as Barack Obama because it's a two-woman ticket and because she has somebody who really represents the left and the disaffected youth. I think that she shouldn't try and reach over to the right, because if Donald Trump is the nominee, the Republican establishment isn't going to be voting for Trump anyway, and is going to try and is either going to sit this out or try and or will be quite happy to come over to somebody like Clinton, who has reasonably sensible policies when it comes to like taxation.
I mean, by sensible, you mean slightly more Republican friendly, I guess.
Yeah, although technically, fiscally, she is to the left of Obama, which a lot of people seem to forget.
To be honest, I haven't had the opportunity to look at her policies in depth, and I guess to some degree that's just my laziness, and to some degree that does actually tell you something about the campaign and the amount it's been driven by personalities rather than by actual policies. But, you know,
Yeah, but that's American politics, isn't it?
it is, yeah,
That's
but.
why we love it, because it's like Big Brother, but serious.
It is a bit sad that, like, after all the exertions of the past, past half year or more, I guess, we've come down to candidates who, in their own ways, are as disappointing as Trump, as you mentioned, you know, a racist, sexist demagogue, and Clinton, who's a habitual liar and not particularly someone I think most people should be able to get behind just on the basis of her past record.
Yeah, but if it does end up being Trump, if the Republican Party don't manage to kind of, to be frank, do one over on Republican voters because Trump is winning, then Do you think that it would be inevitable to have Clinton as the next president of the United States?
Are you saying that if the Republicans...
If the Republican Party have to have Trump as their nominee?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see Trump actually beating Clinton, although I guess, you know, every safe prediction that has been made about this contest, at least on the Republican side of things, so far has turned out to be wrong, or at least all the main predictions. You know, nobody expected Trump to get this far, as he has done. But just to sort of turn that question around, how bad do you think it would be if Trump, through some strange turn of events, actually managed to enter the White House and become president of the United States?
Hope that those 4 years go really quickly.
So, do you think it would be as apocalyptic as...
Yeah, I think it would be terrible. He wants to restrict the amount of freedom of speech that journalists have when they report on him. He wants to be able to sue absolutely everybody under the sun. Internationally, the US will become more reclusive. He doesn't want the US to be interventionist internationally anymore, which is going to be terrible for the likes of us who are trying to fight a war in Syria at the moment. His economic policies are going to fall through the roof, are going to make the US economy fall through the roof. I reckon there's going to be a mass exodus to Canada. The amount of people Googling for how do I move to Canada is quite hilarious. Did you see the
Wait, just before you ask me another question, I just have to wonder, like, the extent to which Congress will actually limit what he's able to do, in the same way that Congress has actually limited what Barack Obama has been able to do these past 8 years or more.
So he can still do quite a lot by executive order. But yeah, this is when you hope that the checks and balances that exist in US politics actually come into effect. Fingers crossed.
So, sorry, what was the question you were asking before?
Did you see the speech by Mitt Romney? So Mitt Romney being the 2012 presidential candidate for the Republican Party.
I haven't actually seen the speech, but I know it was widely reported on, and he slagged off Trump, effectively.
Slagged off Trump big time. And he's somebody who's really very well respected. Like, he's genuinely really loved in the Republican Party. He's kind of... like, for a while after 2012, he was seen as like the de facto leader, and lots of people were begging for him to run again. And there's also there have been whispers. There's all of this thing about the Republican Party trying to reduce the chance of Trump being their nominee. There's talk of him coming into the race late, Mitt Romney joining the selection process late, so that he splits the vote more, and so that Trump's vote gets reduced. It's all a bit far-fetched, to be honest. But if you haven't heard that speech or seen that speech by Mitt Romney, he takes Trump apart, and it's a wonderful piece of political theatre.
I think that's probably quite a good point to end it on, because I'm sure we're going to end up discussing Trump and Clinton as the potential, potential presidents in the run-up to November quite a few times.
I hope so, even though you keep cock-blocking me on this topic.
I'm just saying,
I think you're very sensible.
Well, the listeners can let us know. Do you actually want to hear us discuss Trump every single week and all of the insane things that he said? Especially given we're going to be discussing Brexit a fair bit as well.
Yeah, exactly. Let us know what you think of this topic and whether we should talk about it more on Twitter at Right Dishonour.
Indeed. And now let's go to the next segment discussing the Irish elections.
Amazeballs.
So last week, the Irish voted in their first general election since 2011, and what we've seen is actually a very similar picture to the elections in Spain and Portugal recently. We've seen a fracturing of the vote, so the incumbent parties were Fine Gael, which is the centre-right party, kind of the equivalent to the Conservatives in Britain, and the Labour Party, which is centre-left, but it's a much smaller party than its equivalent in Britain. So the senior Fine Gael party and the junior Labour Party both saw a reduction in their votes, but the Labour Party were sort of wiped on the map in a manner kind of akin to the Liberal Democrats in Britain. And Fianna Fáil, which is the kind of the centre, the major centre-left party in Ireland grew their vote, but the problem is that no party now has enough votes to govern properly, in the sense of having a majority in the what is their equivalent of the House of Commons, which
There was the suggestion, so it looks like when you look at the breakdown of each of the votes, that there could be a grand coalition between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Why do you think that that can't happen?
So from what I've read, Fianna Fáil have effectively ruled that out and said they're not interested in the Fine Gael. The still the current Prime Minister, I think, technically, Enda Kenny, has also said that he's not too interested in doing that, and he's still effectively clutching onto power. And I think there's the sense that if he builds that grand coalition, it will not end well for him, and his career will be over. So that's why I don't think it will take place. The thing is, I think from my understanding, the Irish political system is still actually heavily built on the Westminster one, to the extent that they still have a slightly more adversarial chamber, and they're kind of less used to the idea of coalitions than they are in continental Europe. But as I said, this kind of mirrors the picture we've seen in continental Europe of the fracturing of the political system, so that no one party can effectively govern. And it does put the Irish in quite a difficult position. The analysis that I've seen on this is that this is kind of a backlash to the austerity policies of the government. Effectively, the Irish people don't feel that they've actually seen the benefits from the alleged recovery of the Irish economy.
They've seen an increase by 7% of their GDP year on year, right? Is that correct?
That is correct, but the GDP is partly illusory. I mean, one of the things that Ireland is known for is actually having a very generous corporate tax system. There's this thing in sort of tax law known as the double Irish, which is a way of structuring your company so that it's kind of legally based in Dublin usually, which means it incurs a very low rate of corporation tax, even if it's mostly doing business in other parts of the EU or even other parts of the world. And because the corporation tax is so low, it means that the Irish people don't really see the benefit of having those large companies quartered in Ireland. So
I know that I'm probably asking a question that you won't necessarily know the answer to, but how do the Irish people feel about themselves being used as like a dodgy tax setup?
I have absolutely no idea as to the answer of that. I'm guessing they're not particularly happy. I think the sense is that across most of Europe and the US is that corporations are taking the piss with tax, and there is, I don't know, I think there's definitely moves generally among certainly the populations, if not the political classes in the West, to there's a desire to actually reform international tax laws so that people can actually collect more tax. I mean, do you have, or governments can collect more tax, do you have a view on just like looking at the election figures, and what do you actually make of what's taken place in Ireland?
I mean, it's scary how nearly parallel this is to, maybe not parallel, but very similar it is to the Spanish elections, which I've been following quite closely. In Spain, the Partido Popular, who were the government before the last election, they are kind of de facto governing now after having failed to run to form a government in the first couple of weeks, because nobody really, despite the fact that there was like a centre-right party that may have wanted to be able to go into coalition with them, they decided to, like, it didn't work out. And now it's kind of fallen to the PSOE, who are the socialists, centre-left party in Spanish politics, and they're currently trying to form some kind of a government. But the resurgent, the very popular Podemos, who are kind of the university intellectual-led hard left-wing anti-austerity party in Spanish politics, who came out of the Indignados movement, which was like the Occupy Wall Street of Spain. Podemos have been like, no, we just want to have, like, we want all of the R things, but none of your things. So being the hard left being incredibly mature as always. And then there's Ciudadanos, Thanos, who are kind of like the center rightish, quite similar to the Liberal Democrats, I suppose, but nothing seems to be working very well there. And Spain will, if there's no government formed, if there's no majority government formed, by the I believe by the end of this month, then they have to have another election in what's next month? January, February, March, April.
April.
Thank you. Good. So do you know, is that what possibly happens here, or are they able, because even if Fine Gael and Fine Foil try and govern as parties in their own right, they're so short of a majority, both of them on their own, that there's like practically no chance of them being able to do anything, right?
Yeah,
Like,
so
just for context, listeners, Fine Gael have 50 seats. Fine Foil have 44 seats, and they need a majority. They need 50 seats for a majority.
in answer to your question, I think it's quite likely that there could be another election, general election in Ireland. In Britain, we actually passed the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which means that there's only a general election every 5 years unless you have a
Super
two
majority.
thirds vote in the House of Commons, which in the run up to our last general election was causing all sorts of constitutional worries because people thought we might be stuck for 5 years with no government effectively, or no government that could actually pass any bills,
I
which
think that
is
would have been quite refreshing, to be honest.
yes, some people wouldn't have seen that as entirely a bad thing, but yeah, I think it's possible there could be another vote. But the trouble in this situation, as has been the trouble in the Spanish situation as well, is that there's very little indication that another vote would actually produce a drastically different result. And what you need in this sort of situation is a drastically different result where one of the parties can actually have a significant majority in the, whichever parliament it is for that country. You've kind of followed a lot of the elections going on in Europe. I know you haven't followed this one very closely, but do you have a sense that this is going to be the norm in Europe for now? We're going to have elections that don't really produce very strong results. And could that even be true of Britain, even though the Conservatives do have a majority in the House of Commons now?
I mean, I feel like people have been saying that for every single election, that they've tried to glean some kind of, oh, this is how elections in Europe work now. Like, we saw it with Greece and how all of a sudden the whole of Europe was going to go super left wing. And then the British election happened and it was like, oh, actually, the establishment and people are going to vote for austerity if you manage to play your cards right. Oh, now Spain have got a hung parliament and can't decide. So that means all of the elections are going to be undecided now. Like, each country has kind of dealt with this in its own way. And I think that it's unhelpful to suggest that, oh, because a couple of countries in Europe have voted this way, that means that the rest of the continent is going to vote this way. We've seen a huge variety in terms of the way that people have, the European people have, first of all, reacted to the financial crash in 2008, the way that they dealt with that. And secondly, in terms of how they dealt with those governments that they brought into power post 2008. Like, I don't think that this is particularly demonstrative of a wider kind of phenomenon in European politics. What I think that is quite interesting, though, is the rise of independents. So independents have like a the way I understand it is that independent, like the Irish equivalent on MPs, independents have a much larger role in the Irish political stage than they do in the UK,
Yeah, so
certainly.
they got 17.5% of the vote in the last general election, independent or candidates not associated with one of the big or even minor parties.
Yeah, and so it feels like I'm almost kind of jealous of the Irish system because vote, like the way that people vote seems to be very tied with like local candidates and who the local candidates are. And this is why the independents are particularly strong in the Irish elections. What's also interesting is that we've seen a rise of Sinn Féin, who are the nationalist party that want a unified Ireland, who want to unify the North and the Republic of Ireland.
It's interesting both... that's happening in the context of the possibility that Britain might actually leave the EU or prepare to leave the EU shortly.
Super interesting, right? But I think that they have they're on the rise because I think they're the most prominent anti-austerity party in Ireland. That's how I understand it anyway. Correct me if I'm wrong, listeners. Please do bash me with your Irish knowledge on Twitter later if you feel like it. We have, and even though Sinn Féin and neither Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael are able to form a majority on their own, Sinn Féin being the third largest party now, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have both ruled that out because of the dodgy history of Sinn Féin kind of being linked to the IRA and terrorism.
So, very, very much slow played that that link there, Jazza.
Thanks.
So you're saying that they've Sinn Féin have actually taken on a kind of more populist mantle then, even more so than I guess you could say Irish nationalism.
That's how it looks from where I'm sitting anyway. Definitely.
Okay. I mean, is there anything else looking at the results that you'd actually pick out as a significant feature? Because we kind of talked about the hung nature of the parliament and the. And also the rise of these other minor parties which have further fractured the system. But are there any other trends that you'd kind of think are interesting?
No.
You're really helping me out there, Jazza.
That like I'm looking at the stats now and that's all I can notice.
All I can notice. Okay, well, it's very clear that we don't know very much about Irish politics, but...
I don't know, I think we did okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, listeners, try and let us know marks out of 10. I'm sure we'll actually come back to this because this it does seem quite likely that they'll have another election relatively soon, and we will promise to do more homework next time. But we should probably move on.
I think you need to stop apologising, Jimmy. I think we did okay.
Okay. Let's try and stagger over to the next segment then. What is it we're talking about?
Well, the Snoopers Charter, my love.
Oh, yeah, that thing. Let's do that. In the last week in the House of Commons, the Home Secretary Theresa May reintroduced her Investigatory Powers Bill, which is better known as the Snoopers Charter. This bill lays out a whole load of, or consolidates a load of new powers for the secret intelligence services in Britain and also the police. A selection of the powers would include things about metadata, which in the bill is referred to as communications data, interception of communications, and the bulk collection of data as well. This is a return of a bill that has been sort of bubbling on and off for the past couple of years. Theresa May tried to introduce it into Parliament in 2014, but it was blocked by the Lib Dems. And now it's come back again, and it's slightly stronger than it ever was before, partly because the Tories now have a majority in government. Jazza, what have you seen of the bill, and what are your first thoughts in relation to it?
Well, first of all, but I'm going to answer your question with a question, because I think that we need to... There's lots of jargon around this bill, which I think is perhaps why it doesn't get a huge amount of national attention, and a lot of the attention that it does get in media tends to be quite sensationalist, because it gets painted as... The government can look at your phones. Ah, panic. Ah, oh, they're going to be looking at that time that you Googled midget porn. Oh, no. When it says, specifically, Jimmy, when it says that it's going to access metadata, what is metadata? What does it mean that they're going to be able to access that?
So metadata is the who, what, when, where, how, and with whom. Sorry, not the what. I'll get onto that in a moment. But it's the information around a particular communication. So
it's stuff like who sent what to whom, the subject line of emails, for example.
I'm not entirely sure if subject lines would be included, but if we just talk about a telephone call on the basis, that's quite a simple communication to understand. So we're recording this over Skype, so it would be able to record my IP address has connected to your IP address via Skype, for instance. That would be an example of metadata, as I understand it. It gives some indication of what's going on. So if somebody looks at your phone records and they can see who you've called, they can also work out roughly where you were when you made that call. I know talking about phone records is slightly obscuring because obviously the internet is works in a different way to the way phones work, but it's just the information around a communication as opposed to the content of the communication itself, which would be, say, the contents of an email, for example.
So, what is it that we need to be worried about here, Jimmy? Because there seems to be the Guardian is particularly has been particularly diligent in the way that it reports this. However, I have been quite annoyed about how sensationalist they've been. They've made it look like some kind of dystopian society that we'd be entering into. Are we, if something like the Snoopers Charter does get passed, and the government is able to end up accessing metadata about the kind of internet history that we have and who we're contacting and the like, what kind of how is that going to change our lives in the day-to-day afterwards?
So the actual bill itself is horrendously complicated because there's different categories of data and all of them have slightly different processes through which the security services can actually access that data. In the case of metadata, there's actually very little oversight of how that is used properly. A judge doesn't need to sign off on a warrant for metadata. The police can actually apply for it within their own organisation, and then it is signed off by an officer who's independent from whichever investigation actually applied for the metadata, as it were. So that's something that I'm not massively happy about, although I understand that probably from an operational point of view, it's way more practical to do that than actually have to go through the rigmarole of going for a judge. For other things like interception, they actually do have to be signed off by a judge. And also, I think I'm not entirely sure about the bulk communications, but there's actually the weakest judicial scrutiny is definitely on the communications data or the metadata, and then there's greater scrutiny on other bits of data, but it does actually still grant the security services a lot of powers. Probably the one area that I'd actually pick up on is this is the point about encryption. And the point
Yeah, so in a previous incarnation, this bill, or this draft bill, was going to ban anything that encrypted, that encrypted information, right? So that would have potentially included stuff like Snapchat and WhatsApp. Is that correct?
Yeah, that I mean,
But has that now been fixed in this bill?
I don't know if it was going to ban encryption per se. There's a slight, but the way the bill is now, there's a slight nuance. It doesn't quite ban encryption, but it does oblige companies in one way or another to decrypt communications at the request of security services. So say that I'm a telecommunications company and I hold say. Or say I'm somebody like Apple and I hold encrypted, there's an encryption tool to encrypt data on an Apple iPhone, as is going on in a similar case in the US.
Encryption for listeners who maybe don't know, because again, I'm really aware of jargon that springs up in stuff like this. Encryption basically means that the information that is stored about like activity online, for example, isn't readable by a third party. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. So,
Okay.
if you say you go onto Google and you search for something on Google, such as midget porn, for instance, to take Jazz's example, that search request will be encrypted when it goes to Google servers, which means that no third party who's observing what's going on can really see what's going on, basically. And there have been instances in the past where encryption has failed, and it's been possible for a hacker to get in between the various points of the internet and actually see what's going on, even though encryption is supposed to be taking place. But as I was saying, that this bill, the Snoopers Charter, actually means that companies will effectively have to decrypt information on request. So if there's a suspect who, let's say there's an alleged terrorist that the police are investigating, and they want to get into his iPhone, and there's Apple's encryption on the iPhone, so they can't get in without Apple's help. what this bill would oblige Apple to do is actually to break it, is to provide some way of breaking into that phone. And the concern is that if Apple are obliged to do that, there's a very strong chance that the technology that they create at some point could be leaked onto the wider internet and could actually be picked up by hackers who would then effectively be able to break into any iPhone anywhere.
Yeah, and we've seen a similar thing happen in the US recently, right?
Exactly, yeah. So in the US, there's actually, the example I gave is an exact mirror of the Sam Bernardino case going on in the, where Apple has been asked by the FBI to break into the phone of one of the terrorists who shot up the, was it a some sort of government facility in the in San Bernardino in California? Is that right?
Perhaps.
Right. So it's.
I'm not sure.
It's something like that, and Apple so far have said no for the reasons I just gave. That if you provide the police with a tool one time round, there's a danger that it could actually weaken security overall, which doesn't really help anyone in the long term, and. I think having read through the Snoopers Charter, I think it does actually create that problem, and that's been flagged as one of the principal concerns, that actually in trying to allegedly make us safer, this bill doesn't make us safer at all. It actually puts us at far greater risk.
So what do we need to worry about as citizens who could possibly have our stuff kind of sifted through? So this... I am playing devil's advocate here because I am actually reasonably worried about this. The main thing that I'm worried about is how complicated it is and how difficult it is to understand by a layperson in terms of, hey, hold on, what is it people are actually going to be able to see? And that means that people will possibly end up monitoring the way that they interact with people online. And I think that that is a negative. I think that that takes away from the positivity of the connected world that we have on the internet. But what is it, if I have nothing to hide, then why do I need to worry? Cliche question.
Yeah, I mean, it is a cliche question. I'm not sure I have a similarly glib answer to it, but I suppose I think that this whole talk about Britain turning into a totalitarian state is generally unlikely, although I would point...
Although Viva Vendetta did make it seem very plausible.
Well, I wouldn't look at Viva Vendetta, but the British government, even in the past 10-15 years, has proved itself very capable of doing very, very authoritarian things. I'm talking about our willingness to ship off our citizens to Guantanamo Bay, where they face torture and worse, and just the whole thing about GCHQ colluding with the American security services. There's very obviously a innate danger in policing, that this is true of Britain, it's true of the wider world, of the police abusing their powers. And this bill opens up the chance for the police to abuse their powers, even if there's not a great deal of political interference in the process, which tends to be the general worry with totalitarian states, is that the police and the security forces are completely in bed with each other. I think the division between the judiciary and the police force and the government in Britain is generally pretty good as it goes, but I think this bill would potentially weaken that, and that would be a problem in and of itself. But just beyond that, would you not prefer to live in a country where, if you wanted to maintain privacy, which I think is just an important part of being a human, you had the option to do so? Even in a world where people share lots of stuff on Facebook, I think that's just a good thing to have. And that's what, yeah, I'd say if people said, if I've got nothing to hide, why should I be worried about this bill? I'd raise those two points.
This is definitely something that we're going to continue talking about on the website as well, rightdishonorable.com. And I will probably be making a video about this online with Oranges in the next couple of weeks as well. Jimmy, the reason that I'm wrapping up is because I'm being called down to dinner. Because this is what happens when I record from my nan's house, and I'm being told off by text as we speak.
Wow. Okay, well, I suppose we better wrap this up then.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, everybody. Please do let us know if you have any questions about the draft communications bill. aka the Snoopers Charter, reach out to either me or Jimmy, and we'll be more than happy to try and point you in the right direction to some resources that will be will explain it a lot better than we do. Also look out for the inevitable barrage of comments that the barrage of content that we'll be making on this in the next few weeks, as well as this bill that refuses to die keeps on coming back.
All right, I think we'll leave it there.
Shall we? Okay, goodbye. Toodaloo. Bye.
Bye-bye.